This podcast is made possible through listener contributions to the ETV Endowment of South Carolina. And the Florence County Museum, presenting Kindred Spirit, The Personal Worlds of William H. Johnson, exploring the painter's artistic evolution and journey of self-discovery from rural South Carolina to Europe and New York. flocomuseum.org.
From South Carolina Public Radio, this is Walter Edgar's Journal. I'm Walter Edgar, welcoming you to our podcast series about South Carolina culture and history with a nod to all things Southern. Today, Alfred and I will be talking with Rick Hatcher, author of the book Thunder in the Harbor, Fort Sumter and the Civil War.
Construction of Fort Sumter in Charleston Harbor began after British forces captured and occupied Washington, D.C. during the War of 1812 via a naval attack. The fort was still incomplete in 1861 when the Battle of Fort Sumter occurred, sparking the American Civil War.
In writing Thunder in the Harbor, Rick Hatcher conducted the first modern study to document the fort from its origins up to its transfer to the National Park Service in 1948. Rick, it's wonderful to have you back here in Columbia on the Journal, and I am very impressed with your book, Thunder in the Harbor, Fort Sumter and the Civil War. And I have two pages of questions that I'm going to fire at you as we go along. But first, let's tell our listeners a little bit about you. You come from Virginia, right?
Yes, sir. Richmond, Virginia.
And then, of course, you ended up in heaven in Charleston, South Carolina.
I was very fortunate. In my National Park Service career, I had always wanted to be the historian for Fort Sumter. And so I was very fortunate to transfer here in 1992 to become the historian for then Fort Sumter National Monument and, of course, the Charles Pinckney National Historic Site.
Okay, which is actually where we first connected in working on the Charles Pinckney site.
Yes, sir.
Okay. All right. Everyone knows about the first shot of the Civil War, but there's much more to the story than just that, even on the Civil War period. But the origins of the fort, the action during the Civil War, and what happened to the fort after the war is all part of a continuous story.
Yes, it is.
How did Fort Sumter come about, or why did it come about?
Well, Fort Sumter is like many of the other brick and stone forts built on the Atlantic coast, Gulf Coast, and even out to Fort Point under the Golden Gate Bridge in San Francisco. It's because of the War of 1812. And after that war, the United States realized how weak our national defenses were. And after that point, Congress began appropriating money to build new and improved coastal defenses along the nation's coastline.
And the designs, the brick and masonry forts, really were 18th century. I mean, they were, after Vauban, the French engineer.
Exactly. He was the man for fortifications in that time period, yes.
So describe Fort Sumter in those terms. It was a star fort, five-star fort?
It's a Pentagon-shaped structure, five sides. The design was done by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers in its headquarters in Washington, D.C., as most all the other forts were as well. And in the late 1820s, engineers came down, surveyed the area of Charleston Harbor, selected the shoal about a mile west of Fort Moultrie across the main shipping channel. And from there, that's where they selected to build the fort under their design. But first, they would have to bring in what would end up being approximately 109,000 tons of rock stone to build an artificial island approximately 2.5 acres in size, sitting about 5 feet above the surface of the water.
I have to ask, where did all that stone come from? Because we didn't have a lot of stone locally, did we?
Correct. Well, especially in Charleston, there really was no stone.
Yeah.
All the sand you could ever want, but really no stone. So the vast majority of that stone from the records we've been able to locate show that they come out of the New England states, Maine, New York, et cetera. Exactly all the quarries we don't know. We just know that the contractors who got to bring the stone to the site were primarily located in Boston and New York.
Okay.
Yeah, because when you said selected the shoal, that's not a, you know, that's underwater.
Correct.
But they built it up to be 5 feet above the water.
Correct. Yes, sir.
And you said how many acres?
The fort's approximately 2.5 acres.
Okay. All right.
So from that foundation of stone and granite, they would build then the brick fort.
And where did the bricks come from?
The bricks, the majority we've been able to find the records for, they came out of local plantations like Boone Hall Plantation up in Mount Pleasant, from the veins of clay found up along the Cooper and the Wando Rivers. And they were able, that's where most of the bricks came from.
I think you've got to figure how many bricks were used to build this incredible fort.
The general working figure is around 7 million, but we haven't found all of them, all the records, I think.
7 million bricks, all handmade in Charleston, South
Carolina.
Correct. Mm-hmm. Okay. And the walls are how thick?
7 feet at the thickest.
All right. So there's 7 feet of brick.
Not exactly. The exterior shell and the interior shell are brick, and in the center, it's rammed concrete.
Wow. Okay. So it was starting off as a very substantial masonry fort.
Yes.
It's kind of interesting, though, in terms of military history. By the time they were building these forts, masonry fortifications could be damaged by the new cannon that were being developed.
Well, still the vast majority of the cannons were smoothbore, but they're getting bigger and more powerful. Even before, as the fort was under construction, as artillery was being improved and the guns were getting bigger, they had to make some adjustments into the gun emplacements in order to accept these larger cannons. The biggest cannon at the time was called the 10-inch Columbiad. It could fire a 128-pound cast iron cannonball, well over 2 miles.
When you talk about a 10-inch, that's the diameter
of the bore of the gun. Right. So the size of the cannonball is 10 inches in diameter, and is made of solid cast iron.
And that cannon weighs how much?
Easily over 30,000 pounds.
Oh, okay. So that's got to be they've got to bring that in by ship and mount it in the fort. Now, the fort had three tiers of cannon, did it not?
On the four principal walls facing the ocean, the shipping channel, and into Charleston Harbor, with three tiers of guns. The fort was designed to hold 135 cannons within its walls and have living space inside for 650 officers and men.
Did it ever have its full complement of either?
No, sir. It never did. Fort Sumter, as I like to tell folks, when South Carolina secedes on December 20th of 1860, Fort Sumter is about 90% complete. So if you think from 1829, when they started to lay the first rock for the foundation of Fort Sumter, coming up to 1860, what do we have? We have a 31-year incomplete United States government project. So if you ever complain about the government taking too long to get anything done nowadays, so all you got to do is look at Fort Sumter. Here it is, 2024, and the fort's still not finished.
Okay. being familiar with some of the other forts like Fort Morgan and Fort Gaines, I think Fort Morgan actually had been completed by the time of the Civil War.
Yeah.
And the number of cannon initially planned for were never installed, right?
Correct. The largest number we can determine is 90.
Well, some of that had to do not with government work, but had to do with how warfare had evolved. And by the time the Confederates were occupying the fort, some of those lower tiers had been filled in and were not cannon ports, right?
No, the first tier was complete. In fact, that's where Major Anderson, during the bombardment of April 12th and 13th, 1861, that's where he had most of his guns mounted most of his counter-battery fire against the Confederate positions around Charleston Harbor. It was the second tier that was never completed. But as the war progressed, the first tier would almost be filled in some areas.
Okay. Let's move on to the war. You mentioned Major Anderson. Let's talk about Charleston, December 1860. South Carolina secedes on the 20th of December. And immediately, like any divorce, the question becomes community property.
Yes.
And so I'll let you take the story from there.
Well, of course, now the South Carolinians, they have taken over the U.S. arsenal in Charleston. They have taken over the site of Fort Johnson. They have moved into Fort Moultrie, especially after December 26th, when Major Anderson moves his command to Fort Sumter. So they have taken over all the federal installations in Charleston except Fort Sumter. And they are very anxious to hold that, claiming it being theirs now that they have seceded from the Union and are the Republic of South Carolina. And they want all federal authority gone from the state. But Fort Sumter is critically important in this overall view because, of course, South Carolina is the only state that has seceded from the Union at this point. And Charleston is the most important seaport for the Republic of South Carolina, the South Carolina secession. So they need to have that channel open so they can get commercial shipping in and out. So get supplies and materials, you know, ship out the rice, ship out the cotton, tobacco, et cetera, and then bring goods in to support their economy. And they can't afford to have now a foreign power, the United States Army, holding this installation that can stop any traffic going in and out of Charleston Harbor.
December 20th secession. On December 26, 1860, Major Anderson moves his Union troops from Fort Moultrie. He abandons Fort Moultrie. They spike the guns.
Yes.
It wasn't until the next day that the Confederates actually realized that he had moved out there, that he did slip away in the course of the night.
Yes, they did. South Carolinians had a couple of patrol boats that were supposed to operate between the two fortifications, but the Federals were able to sneak right under the noses, especially one of the boats, and make a very successful transfer of not just his garrison, but also the enlisted men, women, and children also went out to the fort with them. So it was quite an accomplishment and an embarrassment for the South Carolina government to have that happen.
So we between December the 26th and April the 12th, United States Army troops are still occupying Fort Sumter, and construction's still going on, isn't it?
Well, not construction. The main thing they're doing now is putting the fort in the best state of defense that they can. They're mounting cannons, and that's their primary mission now, to be able to defend themselves to the best of their ability. So construction's gone. In fact, construction materials, the buildings there are being torn down, and they're being used for firewood. And so the materials that are there are being put in a defensive nature, not in an attempt to complete the construction of the fort.
So we're talking about almost 4 months, and it's got the place that's got to be supplied. Where are they getting their foodstuffs?
Well, remarkably, the same contract that the quartermaster had at Fort Moultrie to get fresh meat and vegetables once a week from the market in Charleston, that was allowed to continue. So
the Republic of South Carolina allowed this, or did they try to obstruct it?
It was stopped initially, then it was allowed to pick up again shortly after Anderson had moved over to Fort Sumter. So we're still talking of somewhat of a gentlemanly view of this activity. South Carolinians, the government wants a peaceful separation.
Ah.
They want to have the Federals go and allow them to go to any other installation they want to transfer to. Just leave. And we don't want to, you know, have any conflict over this. So there were already rations there at the fort, so the standard rations. But once again, Governor Pickens, Francis Pickens, allowed the quartermaster to go once a week into the city of Charleston and supply the meat and vegetables that the garrison would need on a weekly basis. And that continued as well. Also, Anderson and his Captain John G. Foster, the commander of the Corps of Engineers working at Sumter, they were allowed to send their mail into Charleston and have it go on to Washington and allow the mails to return. And the postmaster in Charleston, the former U.S. postmaster, Alfred Hughey, allowed that. And he said, I will guarantee the mail. We will give you a mail bag. You put all your official and personal correspondence in this, and they can we'll take it and get it on the train and send it north. And the return were allowed. So that went on for months. And the Confederates even allowed it after it came under the control of the Confederate States of America. This was allowed for up until April.
What about telegraph communications?
There was a telegraph office there. There were some telegraph communications allowed. You got to remember, once you got out of South Carolina at that time, North Carolina is still in the Union. Virginia is still in the Union. It's not until after the bombardment of Fort Sumter do Virginia, North Carolina, Tennessee, and Arkansas secede. So those communications continued as well.
Well, Anderson's move, some of the folks in Washington, even in the Army, said he didn't have the authority to do what he did.
Yes. They were vague, and especially in President James Buchanan's administration with Secretary of War Floyd, who was a Virginian. He was given a lot of latitude. He wasn't given a lot of specific direction. The main issue was that he was given permission to move his forces from Fort Moultrie into any of the other installations in Charleston Harbor, Castle Pinckney, Fort Sumter, wherever he thought he needed to go to avoid the effusion of blood. And so Anderson looked at Fort Sumter, completely surrounded by water. So it was the most easily defensive position he had available to him, and took that advantage on the night of December 26th. And so by Secretary Floyd's interpretation, you know, what have you done? You have reinforced Fort Sumter. He goes, you know, no, I have not reinforced Fort Sumter because there was no force there to begin with. I have only moved my command from one installation to another. Because of that vagueness in the directions coming from Washington, Anderson saw that opportunity.
Historians have often talked about President Buchanan flapping in the wind, couldn't decide what to do. And of course, there were South Carolinians like William Trescott, who basically was functioning as Secretary of State, who was keeping South Carolinians informed of everything that was going on in the nation's capital.
Exactly. Because of these issues in Buchanan's administration, his Secretary of State had resigned, and so President was taking his place, filling in.
All right. So we've got Major Anderson and his force there. How large is his garrison?
We have 84 officers and men, and we have a contingent of civilian employees of the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. Most of them were Charlestonians, and so when Anderson arrived at Fort Sumter, most of them resigned and left. But there was a contingent from Baltimore who were loyal, and they would remain and help with placing the defenses in proper order as best they could. They would assist the garrison and the Corps of Engineer officers who were there.
Okay. Well, between December and April, we've got a standoff.
Yes, and it reaches that point where, of course, on January 9th, a relief expedition sent by President Buchanan is turned back from the firing on the Star of the West by the Citadel cadets. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, President-elect Lincoln, he comes in March 4th of 1861, and he's getting information on the situation in Charleston Harbor. And in early April, he orders a relief expedition to Sumter of provisions and soldiers. But he sends two messengers down to meet with the governor, Governor Pickens, and tells him that if there's no opposition, I'm only going to bring in provisions. If there's any opposition to this, I will try to bring in both provisions and soldiers. And now we have General Pierre-Gustave Toutant Beauregard. He's the Brigadier General Command of Confederate Forces, all the forces in Charleston Harbor area.
Beauregard is there, so this is no longer just South Carolina running the show. This is a Confederate defensive issue.
Well, you got to remember now, you know, South Carolina secedes on December 20th of 1860. Mississippi is the next to go out in January of 1861. And eventually we have all the deep southern states from South Carolina all the way to Texas secede from the Union, form the Confederate States of America in February of 1861 in Montgomery, Alabama. And now South Carolina is part of the Confederate States of America. So all the principal decisions are now going to be made from Montgomery, Alabama, with Jefferson Davis and his cabinet, and General Beauregard. He's the first brigadier general commissioned in the Confederate Army, and he is ordered to Charleston and arrives on March the 3rd and assumes command of all the operations for the Confederacy in Charleston Harbor. So now everything is essentially going through General Beauregard, who is in communication with the authorities in Montgomery. And once again, the Confederate government wants to have Anderson leave peacefully. And they don't call for surrender. They call for evacuation. So they don't want to cause any dishonor to Anderson and his garrison. So they're calling for evacuation, not surrender. Now, Beauregard is communicating this with Anderson and going back and forth. And finally, when President Lincoln orders his relief expedition and his emissaries arrive and speak to Governor Pickens and tell him they're on the way, Pickens calls Beauregard in to the meeting. And, of course, they send telegrams to Montgomery, Alabama, and they say, no. You cannot allow this to go on. This stalemate has gone on too long. Now, Charleston is the most important port on the South Atlantic coast of the Confederate States of America. This is going to be a crucial lifeline for the Confederacy, once again, to get rice, tobacco, cotton out, and commercial goods in to support the Confederacy and keep it going. And also diplomatically, how is the Confederacy going to be viewed as a legitimate government if it can't control the principal seaport on the Atlantic coast of its country? How is it going to be recognized by England or France diplomatically if United States artillery can stop any ship, domestic or foreign, from coming in and out of Charleston Harbor? So they have to go.
At this point, the quartermaster's not getting any more food out of Charleston, is he?
Right. That has finally been stopped. The mails are still continuing, but there's no food coming in. So Anderson and his garrison have to rely on whatever rations they have remaining, and they are quickly dwindling. But back on February 3rd, Anderson had made arrangements for the wives and children of the enlisted men to be removed, and they went to Fort Hamilton in New York, outside of New York City. So now we're only having to feed soldiers and these civilian engineer employees.
Okay, and Beauregard's aware of this, right?
Oh, yes.
He's aware that supplies are dwindling. In early April, before the bombardment, there's sort of a delegation that goes out to Fort Sumter.
On more than one occasion, members of Beauregard's staff, sometimes two, sometimes three members of his staff, are sent out to talk with Anderson about evacuating. And he continues to refuse. And in a nutshell, he says, unless I am ordered out, starved out, or bombed out, I am not leaving until I am out of food. And in the final negotiation, he says, I will leave at noon on April 15th, 1861. I will be out of rations. But they know the relief expedition is coming. In fact, the first ships of that are arriving off the entrance to Charleston Harbor in the pre-dawn hours, and actually into the evening of April the 11th, the first ships are arriving. So Beauregard contacts Montgomery, and he finally gets this final message. He says, you make one final offer to have them evacuate.
And before we get into that, the fort is right there at the mouth of the harbor, and they are flying a huge United States flag.
Yes. At the time, United States garrison flags were 20 feet by 36 feet. It's a huge United States flag.
A daily reminder that somebody else controls Charleston Harbor.
Exactly.
Okay. So Beauregard gives his ultimatum.
And Anderson rejects that ultimatum. that he is informed that the Confederate guns will open fire upon him at 4:30 in the morning on April 12, 1861. The Confederate emissaries go over to Fort Johnson. There's a two-gun mortar battery there with 10-inch Seacoast mortars in them. And at 4:30 in the morning, the first shot is fired from one of those 10-inch Seacoast mortars, and it explodes directly over the fort. And that is the signal for all the Confederate guns bearing on Fort Sumter to open fire.
Okay. Does Sumter fire back? And if they are, what are they firing at?
Yes, they will. But Anderson's command will wait until dawn so they can properly see what they're shooting at. Of course, in those days, everything was called direct fire. You have to see the target before you can hit it. We don't have the indirect fire from artillery and things that we're familiar with today. And so Anderson knows he has a limited supply of artillery rounds and cannon powder. And so he wants to wait until dawn so he can make sure they're going to hit what they're shooting at. And he will direct most of his defensive fire against Fort Moultrie. Fort Moultrie is the largest now Confederate installation. It has the most guns, and so that's going to receive the most of the bombardment on Fort Sumter is going to come from Fort Moultrie. It's also going to come from Confederate batteries on Cummings Point on Morris Island. It's going to come from Fort Johnson on James Island. It's going to come from Mount Pleasant to the north. So Fort Sumter is fired upon from north, south, east, and west, and there's 43 heavy Confederate guns that are going to fire on the fort from all the points of the compass.
And immediately, the impact is obvious. The solid shot blowing the brick away.
They gouge out brick, but none of the Confederate rounds will penetrate that 7-foot thick brick wall, so that fort. The issue is high arching Confederate fire from the mortars and some of the other cannons, where they will fire hot shot and exploding shell. And of course, hot shot are solid cast iron cannonballs heated in furnaces until, as is said in the artillery's manual, until they're cherry red. And what they will do is they'll come up at a high angle and land inside the fort, coming in through the roofs of the barracks buildings and officers' quarters, and set them on fire. And, of course, the shells are coming in at a high angle as well, and they're exploding in the barracks buildings and officers' quarters and setting them on fire.
So how long does this bombardment continue before Anderson evacuates?
Well, the bombardment lasts 34 hours. It ends on the afternoon of April 12th when arrangements are made for a ceasefire and then negotiated. In the words of the Federals, they make arrangements for an evacuation. And, of course, for the Confederates, they consider it a surrender now because now we have armed conflict. We have a bombardment that's going on. So there's no longer an evacuation. This is a surrender of Fort Sumter in the eyes of the Confederates. And those arrangements will actually take place, and the actual evacuation will take place the following day on April 13th.
And so where do Major Anderson and his soldiers go?
Well, they go to Fort Hamilton, New York. They go to New York.
How did they get out of Charleston?
Well, the relief expedition from President Lincoln is sitting outside the harbor, and they make no attempt to come in and assist Anderson in the bombardment. And so the Southerners provide a ship that can pick up his command and take them out to the relief expedition. And so then they sail north and arrive in New York City.
So there was a pier at the fort, just like there is today for the tourists to get off, right?
The pier at Fort Sumter at the time was much more substantial. It was made of stone, and it was about 140 feet long.
Wow.
It was an impressive structure. The one today is not nearly as fine as the one that would have been there in 1861.
Okay. So Anderson's troops depart, Confederates occupy, and they raise a very large flag as well.
Right. They actually raised two flags. They raised the First National Confederate flag and the South Carolina state flag. So those are the first two official flags for the Confederacy raised over the fort.
And how long does it take before federal forces decide to attack Fort Sumter?
Technically, there is no combat against Fort Sumter until 2 years later on April 7th, 1863. Charleston Harbor comes under blockade by the United States Navy, but there's actually no combat again, directly against Fort Sumter until 2 years later, once again, April 7th, 1863, where we have the Ironclad attack. Now, this is unique in United States naval history because for the first time in the history of the United States Navy, we have a fleet of 9 Ironclad vessels go into battle, and they're going to go into combat against Fort Sumter and the Confederate defenses on Sullivan and Morris Islands. So it's going to be a tremendous battle. It's going to last 2.5 hours. The opposing sides will fire over 90 tons of artillery projectiles at each other. The largest cannon to see combat in the Civil War against Fort Sumter and other places against the Confederacy will be the 15-inch Dahlgren, a naval cannon. Of course, a 15-inch bore diameter. The barrels on those guns weigh around 42,000 pounds and fire a 440-pound solid-shot cannonball.
Well, you have a number of wonderful sources that you use, particularly accounts from Confederate officers. The Grimble lieutenants, Arthur and William. I love what Arthur wrote about the Ironclad fleet.
Oh, yes.
And he described the battle in a letter to his sister on April the 21st. To sum it up shortly, we fired, they fired, they fired, we fired. When they left, we were glad. When they did not come back, we claimed a glorious victory.
Yeah, that's wonderful. And in all my years of reading about the Civil War and studying it in quotes, diaries, and things of battles, that is the best quote I have ever read of any combat action.
It's pretty darn succinct.
Yes, it is. It's wonderful.
They were brothers?
Yes. Arthur was a member of the Confederate Signal Corps stationed in the fort, and his brother William was a lieutenant of the 1st South Carolina Artillery Regiment regulars garrisoning the fort.
And so they're there for most of the war.
There's a good part, yes.
Now, the Confederates began to recycle the garrison over time, did they not?
Yes, they did. For the first couple of years, the first South, well, it was the first, it was the South Carolina Battalion of Artillery first to garrison the fort. Then that was expanded to a full regiment and redesignated the 1st South Carolina Artillery Regiment regulars.
So how many men are we talking about?
We're talking about at the most 500 that we can determine were garrisoning the fort. And the fort had a maximum, it had a 90 cannons and mortars in its defense. So it never realized its full complement of 135 guns or 650 officers and men because, once again, it was never completed.
So how are these folks housed? Are they housed in the casemates or?
After the bombardment, the Confederates rebuilt the officers' quarters and the enlisted men's barracks. So these were 3-story-high structures for the men to live in. There were 2 enlisted men's barracks and 1/2 of the building along the interior of the gorge wall served as the officers' quarters. And that's where they were housed. But the garrison really starts cycling in and out when the Union artillery, well, the United States Army forces get control of Morris Island, and then along with the United States Navy blockading ships outside the harbor, they will start bombarding Fort Sumter in August of 1863. And there will be 3 major bombardments, 7 minor bombardments, and 10 instances of desultory fire. And because of the overwhelming firepower of the United States Army and Navy's artillery, Fort Sumter is pretty much being battered into rubble, and it no longer can serve as an artillery installation. So most of the cannons that they can recover, the Confederates will cycle those out at night and get rid of those and place them in other installations around Charleston Harbor. And infantry will move in and become the principal garrison of Fort Sumter starting in about September, October 1863. The principal garrison of Fort Sumter is an infantry garrison and not an artillery garrison. And because of the intensity of the bombardment, every week, 10 days, 2 weeks, that garrison will be cycled out and a new garrison be brought in because of just the intensity of the bombardment.
All right. There were several attempts to mount infantry against Fort Sumter, right?
Well,
we call them an amphibious.
It was an amphibious assault, and actually, there was only one amphibious assault, and that was by the United States Navy, and Marine Corps. And that happened in September of 1863. And that was a horrible defeat for them. About 400 sailors and Marines made this night amphibious assault arrive. The first two waves of boats arrive around 1 a.m. on the morning near the rubble of Fort Sumter. And the Confederates know they're coming, because all the way back at the Ironclad attack on April 7th, 1863, the U.S. Ironclad Keokuk had received 90 hits, 15 penetrating its armor. It sank off the south end of Morris Island. And in May 1863, the Confederates went out there, recovered both of the 11-inch Dahlgrens off that boat, and also got the signal code book. And essentially, for the rest of the war, the Confederates were able to read the signals between the United States Army and Navy on Morris Island and out in the ships in the channel. And so they knew what was coming. And so they were able to prepare themselves for this night assault. And the Federals never changed the signal code through the entire siege operation against Fort Sumter.
Wow.
So the Confederates had that communication advantage.
It's like the Brits in World War II breaking the Enigma code.
Yes. And so... The Confederates were waiting on the parapet in the rubble, and the fight only lasts about 20 minutes from Confederate volleys from the infantry. Members of the Signal Corps, like Arthur, are throwing chunks of brick down at the Union Navy and Marine Corps, and that sort of thing. Hand grenades are being thrown, and over 100 sailors and Marines are killed, wounded, or captured out of 400. And it only lasts 20 minutes. And the Confederates didn't suffer one casualty in that entire action.
Okay. What about casualties in Fort Sumter during the course of the war?
It's remarkable. Fort Sumter did an excellent job of saving lives, of preserving the garrison. And the Confederate Corps of Engineers did excellent work in moving rubble around, reinforcing areas, bringing in sandbags. So over the course of the entire operation of Fort Sumter, the Confederates only had 339 soldiers and civilian workers there, including enslaved laborers, killed, wounded, mortally wounded, etc., injured over the course of the entire siege operation. And this is the longest siege in United States military history. This runs up 587 days from July 10th, 1863 until February 18th, 1865. And so of all this action, 7 million pounds, an estimate, it's probably more than that, 7 million pounds of artillery projectiles being fired at Fort Sumter over the course of the various bombardments from the United States Army and Navy. And they only suffer 339 killed, wounded, injured, or mortally wounded.
Gentlemen, I hate to interrupt, but we need to start wrapping things up. And we got to remind folks that Fort Sumter went on to serve after the Civil War, too. So. Right.
Correct. Now, of course, after the war, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers comes in, starts removing the rubble and debris, and reestablishing Fort Sumter as a fortification to guard the entrance to Charleston Harbor. They will lower weakened walls. They will reinforce others. And the average height of the walls of Fort Sumter today are around 25 feet.
And then, of course, then the Spanish-American War comes, and that changes literally the design and nature of Fort Sumter.
Yeah, it's well known that brick forts are obsolete because of the advances made with rifle artillery and now breech-loading rifle artillery. So they modernize Fort Sumter like they do with many of the other old brick coastal fortifications. They build a reinforced concrete fortification in the middle of Fort Sumter. It's called Battery Isaac UG. Named after Revolutionary War Brigadier General UG for South Carolina. It mounts two 12-inch, one's disappearing rifle cannon, the other one's a fixed gun. These are huge guns weighing about 53 tons apiece and are firing 900 to 1,000-pound armor-piercing projectiles about 10 miles out into the Atlantic.
Well, and what they build that concrete battery, which is still there, but then they fill in the rest of Fort Sumter with sand.
Yes. to help protect. So the old brick walls of Fort Sumter essentially become a retaining wall to help keep in the earthen fill to protect the new modern battery.
Okay, and Fort Sumter still remained a United States garrison or post through World War II.
Yes, it's not closed until 1947. It's essentially decommissioned by the War Department. The legislation goes through, and in 1948, it becomes Fort Sumter National Monument, transferred to the National Park Service. And then in 2019, the fort is redesignated to include Fort Moultrie, and now it is Fort Sumter Fort Moultrie National Historical Park.
You've been there or were there for almost 30 years as a historian. There are wonderful exhibits in Battery UG. That's your museum space. But the interpretation of both forts has changed over time.
It has changed tremendously. When I first arrived in 1992, all the exhibits at Fort Sumter were being revamped. We also did the same thing at Fort Moultrie to bring them up to a more accurate and present-day interpretation. And so I worked on that quite a bit when I first arrived there. And it's an ongoing thing. As I like to call it, new history. You know, we go out and we find new accounts, new documents, find other materials that can help tell the story with better clarity and more inclusion.
Okay. Any last words for our listeners today, Rick, before you sign off?
Well, I've had a great time, and I appreciate you having me up, and I'm glad you enjoyed the book.
Well, Rick Hatcher, the author of Thunder in the Harbor, Fort Sumter and the Civil War, thanks so much for being with us today on The Journal.
And thank you for having me.
Hope you enjoyed today's journal. I know that I did. It was a pleasure having Rick join us to tell the story of Fort Sumter. His book, Thunder in the Harbor, fills a large gap in the historiography and underscores that there is still much to learn about the American Civil War.
Walter Edgar's Journal is a production of South Carolina Public Radio. I'm Alfred Turner, and I produce the show, which is made possible by listener contributions to the ETV Endowment of South Carolina. Remember, the views and opinions expressed on Walter Edgar's Journal are not necessarily those of South Carolina Public Radio or its underwriters.
New episodes of Walter Edgar's Journal are published on the first and third Fridays of the month and are available at southcarolinapublicradio.org, on the SCETV app, as well as your favorite podcast provider. We'll talk again soon.